Why is Imam Hussein important? It's a really good question. And the way that I see it is, first of all, Imam Hussein is for humanity. It's for everyone. When you see that he sacrificed himself for justice, he never stood for oppression, because he was against someone who openly was corrupted, you know, and he was never believed in the message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He was doing things that a leader shouldn't have been doing. So therefore, he stood against it, and he had no right. He had every right to stand against it. That's why I think that we look up to, like, we look us as Shia, we look after him, because we stand for humanity, justice against oppression, and the freedom. You know, that's the main thing that we all, as a human being, you want freedom, I want freedom. So what a great example Imam Hussein has given us, you know.
Now, Sister Zainab, what does Ashura mean to you? I know you're a mom, mashallah, you're, you know, very active in the community. What does Ashura mean to you? What does the practice of Ashura mean to you?
I think over the years it has meant different things throughout the different phases of my life. It used to be a time, actually it still is, it's Muharram is a month that I crave. It's the spirituality that comes with it, the majalis, the sense of community. All of it is something that, you know, with our very busy, hectic lifestyles, it's so easy to get lost in things that are really not important. And Muharram and the Arba'een recenters me. Listening to the story of Karbala, the messages that we have learned from them, the things that we should be applying to our day-to-day life, is definitely like a center point for me throughout my year. But going to the majalis and having the sense of community and seeing how everyone is focused on one goal and commemorating the imam, and you know, and that's shown even more in the Arba'een when you are with people, millions of people from all over the world, from various different countries, all walking in that same direction, the sense of unity that it gives me, I think that's the main thing.
That sense of unity for me actually is mirrored in Hajj, you know, when the adhan goes off and everybody just, you know, uniform.
Absolutely.
Get into, like, it's, yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's exactly what it is. I unfortunately haven't been able to go to Hajj yet, but I do feel that in the Arba'een, where it's, you know, you feel like Sirat al-Mustaqim, and everyone is on this path walking, and everyone around you who's not walking is helping you in your walk. They want to help you with giving you food, with giving you shelter, with giving you a massage. That sense of unity is unmatched for me, and I crave it, and I miss it. And also, knowing that when injustice takes place, what our role and what our duty is, because just like the brother said, we are faced with Yazids in our day-to-day life on whatever scale it is. Knowing that what my duty and what my obligation is, knowing that it can be done, and also knowing that the truth will always prevail, even if I don't see it in my lifetime, is something that gives me a lot of motivation.
Absolutely. And the teachings of Imam Hussein, you know, we have them on a personal level, but you kind of started to talk about how it affects the world stage a little bit. You know, everybody from all walks of life, they come together to walk towards Imam Hussein. But let's actually, if I can recenter the discussion a little bit around the revolutions or the causes that Imam Hussein's message has touched or has provoked reactions, been made a catalyst to. Sirwan, you know, you're a political analyst, you know very much about the region of Iraq, Iran, etc., the Middle East. In your opinion, what has Imam Hussein's message provoked, created as a catalyst in the region in terms of fighting against oppression?
Mm-hmm. Imam Hussein's message, particularly for Shia Muslims, has always been a symbol, a unifying factor, where they've used that as inspiration for the struggles that they've faced. The Islamic Revolution of 1979 for Iran is a massive example, where it was a very strong echoing of what took place in Karbala, the symbolism, and so forth. The militias in Iraq, since ISIS took over on a more recent time, was a massive influence as well. Hezbollah in 1985, when they were founded, were strongly inspired by Imam Hussein's message, and the symbolism is used in language, in poetry, in flags, in commemorations. It's not just with him as well. It's also a universal message. Mahatma Gandhi took inspiration from Imam Hussein. There's a famous quote that he used that he references Imam Hussein. There's another one from Nelson Mandela, surprisingly, as well. There's Edward Gibbon from the 19th century, when he was writing about the fall of the Holy Roman Empire, referenced the Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein. So it's been inspiration to a whole lot of movements, because it is such an incredible example where 72, most estimates are between 72 to 130 companions on Imam Hussein's side. That's how large his army was, facing an army of anywhere between 1,000 to 30,000 or more, depending on the traditions. And there's been no such example of history of such a certain defeat by one group, and yet there were members of the opposing army that joined the losing side. I personally haven't come across such an example, but it exists in Karbala. It's just such an astonishing message and such an astonishingly inspirational point of view that Imam Hussein was able to convince people to walk into absolute certain death when they were facing quite the opposite at that time, when they were facing absolute victory. So, yeah, it's been a very inspirational message.
I think many people have also, Zainab, for you, I know that Palestine is very, it's a cause that's very dear to your heart. And a lot of people have spoken about today's Karbala being Palestine. Do you agree?
I think the message of Karbala is, because it's so as universal as we've been saying, applies to very large scale issues like the brother mentioned, and also much smaller ones. If we go by the message being that the truth will always be there, and if we go that the oppressor will face what they have coming. Mm-hmm. It might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, but it's going to come. Mm-hmm. And if we believe that, you know, with Allah's justice, and knowing that death does not mean losing. Death, if anything, you know, like it says in the Quran, don't even think of them as dead in martyrs in the fi sabilillah. When we take all these messages on board and we remind ourselves about these things in our day-to-day life, then I think then going back, yes, every single one of the situations that we face now, we have to deal with it with the inspiration that we have received from Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his message.
And I think it's vacant, the discussion that we're having, without actually talking about the Yazid of our time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you know Imam Hussein wouldn't have fought against just anything. You know, there has to be a tyrant, an oppressor. Who is that for us in today's world, do you think?
It's countless on the individual level. You have all the sorts of Yazid in your workplaces, in your schools, whether you're the
we're
children.
We're definitely talking about on a common Yazid for all mankind.
Oh, absolutely. On the large scale, of course, there's the Israeli-Palestine issue. That's a very dear issue, not just to the people sitting here, but to all Muslims. There's, you know, the Uyghurs in China that are facing massive issues against the Chinese government. There's a genocide going on. There is Muslims are suffering under the recent government in India. There are issues in Pakistan with Shia Muslims being killed. There's, without question, hijabis being oppressed in France and, you know, banned from attending schools and workplaces if they wear the hijab. So there's Yazids everywhere, unfortunately. Even in our current era, no matter how much we fight, there's always Yazids.
That's very true. It's something that I think most people who commemorate Imam Hussein realize this, and for the majority of the time, it's actually not just Muslims. I think you were kind of hinting at that point, that this isn't, you know, the stories of Imam Hussein and Yazid, it's not limited to Islam or Shia Muslims. Mm-hmm. You know, we all face it. Mm-hmm. Just in summary, do you feel that Imam Hussein's message is universal? Is it an inclusive message?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, first of all, in terms of inclusivity, if you just look at the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that was an army made up, it was a small army, but it was an army made up of people from different backgrounds and different tribes. The first person who comes to my mind is John, you know, mm-hmm. One of the famous companions of Imam Hussein. The message itself has nothing to do with a single tribe or a single person or a single religion. It is about standing up to injustice. It is about acknowledging injustice and trying to spread good. And that's in the words of Imam Hussein himself. When he explains what he is doing, he says that I am trying to revive the message of my grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and spread good and forbid evil. Anyone who sees injustice and remains quiet against it is part of the injustice. Mm. Now, that injustice can be towards Muslims, it could be towards animals, it could be towards absolutely anyone. The message applies to every person in every single day.
Ahsanti. Mm. And Sirwan, is the message of Imam Hussein, is it universal?
Absolutely. You don't need to be a Muslim or a Shia to draw inspiration from it. We were mentioning earlier that all sorts of other political figures that were non-Muslim drew inspiration from the Imam. And just earlier this week, there is a food drive that is done by people here in London and we were dropping off the massive pot that is donated by an Indian restaurant, and we spoke to the owner as we were dropping it off. Turns out he's a Sikh, and he's read extensively about Islamic history, and to our surprise, he gave us, we didn't even ask any questions, he straight away told us for 30 minutes about how the message of Imam Hussein resonates with him deeply, and he has referred to it and leaned on it in times of distress, and me and my friend were quite surprised, and subhanAllah.
Absolutely, great story. Thank you so much for sharing that. Imam Hussein does unite us all. Okay, that's all we have time for today. Thank you to all of our guests, and thank you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we have been discussing about the issue of the continuity of the prophetic mission, focusing on the first sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we say that there are four elements that need to be present. Either of these four elements have to be present for that continuity to happen, and that is the presence, the physical presence of the Prophet, or the presence of the book, or the presence of clear and binding arguments, or if even that is absent, or if that is there but it's not clear, then we talk about what we call أو محجة قائمة, a path which is present, which is there, which exists, which is standing, قائمة, which is something that stands, something that has withstood the course of time and is there, present and usable.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when we say mahajjatun qa'ima, what does it mean? We talked about all of those other things previously, the other three aspects. Now we want to see that sometimes it is possible that we don't have enough statements or teachings that are clear present from the prophets, or we have them, but there are some contradictory statements. So because of the way they have been narrated, or because of time and the way they were recorded, so they are not coming in well. Like, so a person gets a bit confused in this situation. Still, even at this time, the prophetic mission can continue through what we call mahajjatun qa'ima. Mahajja, basically, it means a path or a road. Mahajjatun qa'ima means a road that is there, that is preserved, that is usable. If a road is there but it is broken, or there are big gaps, there are huge, let's say, crevices or holes or craters, then that means that road is not usable, or is not there, is not present in a way. Mahajjatun qa'ima is that road that is usable, that can be utilized, that is present, and you can actually pass through that easily. Sometimes what happens is that because of the teachings of the prophets throughout the ages, there is a certain road that is created. And these roads are those teachings that not necessarily you do not know them specifically as statements or words in your mind. Like, you don't have them written down as words or statements or as a book or as, for example, a collection of narrations. No, not necessarily that way. But it is a style of working, a style of thinking, and a type of living and lifestyle that is, you can say that has been inherited due to the teachings of the prophets. So let me give you an example. As human beings, you don't need to have specific statements to tell you that, you know, killing a person suddenly on the road just because he angered you is something good to do. You don't need a prophetic statement to tell you that. But the prophets told us throughout time that, you know, just going and attacking people, killing them for material gains, is not something correct. The prophets fought against all of these things. Cheating, lying, wrong dealings, right? Everyone knows this is wrong. Now, you can say that, yeah, this is something that is there already ingrained in our spirits. But it's not necessarily like that. There needs some sort of support from outside, which was in the form of the prophetic teachings.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, we say that there are certain understandings about how we deal with things, the do's and the don'ts, and certain understandings we have about the universe, about God, about, you know, the angels, about different things that are there in all people, like all religious people have them, but not necessarily written down in form of specific books. Or it can be like that, that certain communities, they follow that process, but they don't have anything written as such. For example, not cheating one another, not lying to one another unnecessarily, okay? Not just attacking people, not oppressing people, or not adhering to people that are corrupt. I mean, you might have a community that does not follow corrupt people, but it is not because it is written in a book, but it is because they attest to it. They feel this is that path that has been laid by the prophets. They might not even know which prophet, or they might have even forgotten that there was a prophet. But this path has been laid for mankind to follow. But this has to be a firm path, a path that is that they can adhere to, and mankind sees this to be a correct adherence. It's a bit of a technical argument, but I don't want to go into the nitty-gritties of the technical argument on how, what this path is. But I'll give you a simple example in the narrations that we have. Is, for example, we have a narration that says, that talks about the fact that the people at the time of Nabi Musa alayhi salam, and some of the Christians also, they have been admonished for following their scholars. Why? Because their scholars were not acting according to what they preached, number one. And number two, their scholars were adhering and were close to oppressors. Now, this admonishment only makes sense if the people had something to adhere to, something to bank on. And that is what we call mahajjatun qa'ima. Inshallah, we shall discuss about that in the coming sessions. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. In this program, we try to answer your questions and queries you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is an Islamic scholar and a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, Qom, Iran. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Well, Professor, in the previous episode, you taught us some of the very beautiful etiquettes of speech that are ought to be taught to teenagers. And that was always speak the truth. Do not backbite, do not speak against someone behind his back, and always be polite, do not use abusive language, do not curse every third person. And when we were talking about backbiting, there's something very close to it, but it's a different thing, and that's being judgmental. Sometimes using the same tongue, our children, they become judgmental at a very early stage, right? Maybe sometimes not having enough conversation with someone, maybe sometimes not pondering over things, and they become judgmental and start speaking about that particular person, about that particular friend, about that particular teacher with their tongues. What is your take on that?
Yes, thank you very much. That's a very important thing, not only for our children, for us grown-ups also it is important. We need to teach them and ourselves, both of us, that what do we mean by being judgmental? Judgmental, for example, let me say that you see someone and his face is red. Now, the fact is that his face is red.
Okay.
Now, face is red, is it because he's angry? It's redness because of the rage that is there within him? Or he's, for example, has a temperature, or for example, he has just come out of bed and his face is still, still red, or he's gone out into the cold and it's become red.
Right.
So there are many causes for the redness of someone's apparent features. So the moment you look at him and you say, "Oh, why are you angry?
Yeah.
What's wrong with you?" So here you are being judgmental.
Judgment.
Maybe just
an appearance.
It's just an appearance. It's something beyond that. We don't know. So the being judgmental, or you are calling someone and his line is busy, phone line is busy. And then you meet him and say, "Oh, whenever I called you, you were on the phone with someone." But he says, "No, I wasn't on the phone with someone." Or especially at that time, a specific time, whenever called you, you were on a call with someone else. What happened was another person was also calling, and I was calling, and those two calls got mixed up, and
right.
Then you
both can't, both kind of saw that this person was busy or engaged.
So that's a judgment,
right?
So sometimes the moment we meet with each other, we pass a remark and that puts him off.
Yeah.
So that's being judgmental. And most of the times, many of the conflicts that come up in our society today, in our interactions with other human beings, children, siblings, they fight based on their judgments.
Right.
And the perception they get.
Right.
Now, we need to teach ourselves and our children not to be judgmental, number one. We need to, even if we get something very negative, hear something negative about about a friend, we need to find, we need to justify that 70 times before
right.
we believe what's
As
being said.
Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes, so we should refrain and avoid becoming judgmental. We should give the benefit of the doubt to the other person.
Right.
So that is very important in our discussion. Our children...
Yeah. There's a very important story that's coming into my mind. I would like to share that with you and audiences. But after a short break, dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Salman Akavi with us, who is discussing with us how to teach your teenagers not to be judgmental or very at the very first instance or many things. Like Professor, I said, I have a story coming into my mind over your discussion, whatever you discussed so far. As a teenager, when I was a teenager, my father met an accident, and then he was not able to go out and earn bread. And then we were all daughters. We had no brother. And my uncle would come now, and he would help us financially or in many other ways for school fees, for everything else. But whatever he would do, like, for example, he would get 1 kg of onions or potatoes. He would make me write that each and everything. I got potatoes that was 2 kgs or 1 kgs, and that was for this much amount, and write the date and write the person who gave you this and make a diary of this. We would all love his help, but we would get disappointed with this fact that he makes us fight each and everything. But after, within very short span of time, he becomes very, very ill, and he's almost on the deathbed. And then he calls upon me and tells me that, look, I know you might have got offended with my behavior when I used to make you write even 1 kg potatoes on a diary, on a notebook. And that was for the fact that you guys had no brother. Your father was, he had met an accident. He was not earning. I didn't want any third person to be judging where they're getting from, where they're earning from, where they're having this amount of money, where they're getting the school fees, where they're getting this and that. So, and I turned my eyes were like wet, and tears started rolling down my eyes. I regretted being judgmental as a teen for my uncle, who was so helpful and who was thinking beyond what we could have thought.
Yes, that's a very emotional interaction you had, and it's heartening to see that you have understood that what I'm trying to bring about this point home, that look, most of the times a person doesn't have time to explain everything. He may be thinking in your interest, he may be thinking of you for bettering your situation or helping you, assisting you, and he can't explain everything. And instead of being thankful to him, instead of appreciating him, you feel offended.
Right.
So now he was doing something with a greater cause. He was trying to look at the bigger picture, but we didn't see the bigger picture. We saw the smaller picture.
Right.
So that is the problem with us, most of us in our interactions. We don't see the bigger picture. And if we are able to look at the bigger picture, even if something is, we're sure 100% that he is doing this as an offense to me, even then, if we look at the bigger picture, we'll try to find some sort of, you know, justification. And
again, that hadith of Imam Ali al-Islam, give 70 positive assumptions to yourself, even if you see something,
exactly,
even if you hear something with your ears, still give 70 positive assumptions to yourself before being judgmental. Professor,
there,
we'll discuss...
For the distance between the eyes and the ear is the difference between the truth and the and falsehood.
Yeah.
Imam Ali says...
Right.
So why? Because it's the difference, the distance between the eyes and the ears. What you look at, you're sure about it.
Right.
You don't need to be judgmental about it.
Right.
But we're listening to something, it's something which you have become judgmental about.
Exactly. We'll discuss more about that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya.
The Prophet ﷺ said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and we are talking about how you can teach your teenagers not to be judgmental about others. When you judge others, you do not define them. You actually define yourself. And that's what Earl Nightingale says, and that's not bad. And here's Professor Salman Akavi helping us with some more Islamic narrations in this regard, not to be judgmental about others. And these narrations have to be taught to our teenagers so that they prevent themselves from making any judgments.
Yes, so we need to make ourselves and our children understand that we have to look at the bigger picture. We have to understand and try to comprehend things within that bigger picture, the whole scheme of things that are around us. And even if, as you mentioned, Mawla Ali in Islam, there's also a narration, and there's also a situation where he says that sometimes people call out my name and abuse me. And I look the other way and I say, they may be calling some other Ali.
Okay.
They may be, you know, so what's happening is that even he knows that the person who is calling you out and is abusing you, you may look the other way and you may even, you know, pass by.
Right. And at the same time, Imam Ali alayhi salam also says that don't be judgmental, especially when you are angry.
Exactly.
When you are angry, because especially when we are angry, we kind of really don't think, we don't look right, left. We start saying things and sometimes we're like very judgmental.
True. And sometimes it's because of the emotions we have. For example, if you listen to someone, to something negative about someone whom you like, you're not ready to accept that, even if it's true. And someone, if you don't like someone, you are ready to accept the worst of things about him. You're not ready to accept that he has any good thing in him. So especially sometimes when you're in a debate, at a political debate, and you're talking about a political leader, and there's a lot of conflict about her personality.
Right.
Those who like that leader, they're not ready to accept anything negative.
Against him.
And those who don't like him, they're ready to accept anything which is... They're not ready to accept anything positive about him. So being objective and based on facts is that even if someone whom you accept to be wrong, you don't accept him to be a good person, you know him to be a bad person, but you need to accept that there's a certain amount of goodness in him. You need to justify those things, or you need to accept those good things about him. Yes, when you're objective about someone, when you're factual about someone, you could say, look, these are the points, these are the good points he has, these are the good things he has, and these are the
negative
things I have. And you're not putting your emotions and your feelings about that person in front of you and in front of your thought process.
Yeah.
You need to think and then say something.
Right. In our neighborhood also, the teenage girls would sit around and they would see one of the teenage girls going out in the morning and coming back in the evening. And since a girl was coming back in the evening, which was not very good in our societies, they would make judgments about that girl. Maybe you never know where she is for all that time. And then we get to know that girl, again, she was also among those girls who had no brother, and she would be doing part-time job after her classes. And all the girls in the neighborhood, those who were teens, were all judgmental. And you never know how many sins you are actually getting on your shoulders. Thank you so much, Professor, for that beautiful discussion. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Face to face.
Hello and welcome to this special edition. The 23rd of July is the martyrdom anniversary of a well-known Iranian scientist, Dariush Rezai Nejad, who occupies a very special place in the hearts and minds of Iranians. To honor his memory, we are joined by his daughter. Thank you very much for coming to this show.
It was an honor.
Before we start our conversation, let's take a look at the biography of your father.
July 23rd, 12 years ago, motorcycle-borne assailants working for the Israeli spy agency appeared out of nowhere and shot at Dariush Rezai Nejad 6 times in Tehran in front of his wife and daughter. 35-year-old Rezai Nejad was the 4th Iranian nuclear scientist to be assassinated in a span of 4 years after Ardeshir Hosseinipour on January 15th, 2007, Masoud Ali Mohammadi on January 12, 2010, and Majid Shahriari on November 29, 2010. Rezai Nejad's wife Shohreh Pirani chased the terrorists and then realized they were shooting at her as well. She ultimately fell to the ground in a wounded state and saw the motorcycle speeding away. Armita Rezai Nejad, their daughter, was only 4.5 years old at the time. She saw the horror unfold before her eyes. Their small and beautiful world crashed down with 6 bullets. But she was too little to understand the magnitude of the tragedy. Armita is 16 now and has grown into a thoughtful young woman with remarkable confidence, composure, and poise.
Welcome back. So, 12 years ago, you were very young, and your father was assassinated before your very eyes. Do you remember anything on that day?
Well, it's not something that you can forget easily, even as a child, I guess. It was really terrifying, and I was so confused. After a while, I started to understand what was happening, and it was really hard to believe, but I kind of got along with the whole thing that happened.
I really don't want to make you relive those moments, but at that time, how aware were you of what exactly had happened?
Well, at first, I didn't see what was happening because I had dropped my doll under my father's seat, and I bent over to take it, and then I came up with the sound of the bullets. The first thing that I noticed was a man, I guess, his face is really black for me. I like he was wearing a mask, but he wasn't. And I saw the gun. And then after that, he ran away. I turned to my father. He was laying on the seats of the car, and there was blood everywhere. Well, as a child, I obviously didn't know that he was dead, but I knew that something bad had happened, so I started screaming and calling him over and over, but he wouldn't answer. And that made me worried, and I was really stressed, and I kept screaming and crying, but there was no answer from him.
When did you come to realize that you had actually lost your father, and how did you feel?
Well, I don't quite remember that, but the thing that has happened is that someone seemed to be telling me that okay, your father is gone forever, and he's never gonna return. I think it was a big shock for a 4-year-old kid. So, as my mother says, I kind of exploded and started screaming and crying, and even when I think of it right now, I remember that it must have been really shocking, because as a child I didn't know what death was, and it was really, I was really afraid of what is coming. But then I forgot what happened because, you know, I think you need to be a grown-up to understand the loss, and I understand it now, but at that time, no.
It must have been very difficult for you.
You could say, yes.
And, of course, daughters and fathers have a very strong bond, usually. And I would like to know more about that bond between you and your dad. How close were you? What are some of the memories that you have?
Well, I don't remember a lot right now. But when I think about it, I only remember the love he had for me. And he was always so specific about my health. And he would always say, for example, wear on your sunglasses. I didn't want to do that because it's really hard. And he always made me do that because the doctor had told me I should wear sunglasses because of my eyes. He took care of me when you want to take care of something really precious. You care about every detail. I think he was like that about me. And his support was this way.
So you must have felt an empty space after he lost your father.
Of course. You know, every person feels that, every loss in someone's life. When you lose a person, there would be an empty space in your life. And, a father for a child would be much bigger empty space. I feel it now. and even that back then, I always felt that.
Exactly, and you've grown into a young lady, and we're very proud to have you here with us today. So I do know that particularly for teenagers, it's a very specific time in your life, and in many cases, you need to talk to your parents. The fact that you don't have your father with you to consult with him, how does that feel?
At first, I have to say that we believe that martyrs can hear us. And whenever I'm in a really big problem in my life, I always ask for help. And he answered me multiple times. I've seen it not like a conversation or something, but he had made things correct the way that they I wanted them to be, and I believe he can hear me now. From that part, it's not like I've lost him like that. He is here with me, not physically, but I can feel him beside me every day and every minute of my life, especially in hard times.
Well, that is great. You know that your father is a hero to millions of Iranians. He is much revered. He occupies a very special place for us. What does it feel like to be the daughter of such an iconic man?
I'm really proud of him. And when I think about what he has done, what he has accomplished, I think like, oh my God, I'm daughter of such a, you know, how should I say it? You know, I don't know how to define it, but if I wanted to define it in teenage language, such a cool person, and he'd done a lot of great things for his country, for our country, and I wish to be like him one day. I want to do what he did. I want to accomplish things like what he accomplished.
And today your face is familiar for many Iranians. You attend a lot of seminars to talk about your father and his legacy. How do you do that?
If I want to say the truth, my mother is a really big part of this. She always pushes me, and she says, okay, you should do this. She challenges me. And I honor that, and she does it really good way, and it's it benefits me. And I get the confidence and courage from her. It's not mine. I'm not that brave, but she's really, she likes me to do this, and she makes me do this.
Well, it's great that you have your mother's support, but I believe you're underestimating yourself as well.
I don't know, but that's what I think, actually, and yeah. But my mother has been always a big part of my life and a great supporter of me.
And how close are you with your mom? Do you believe that your mom has been able to fill that empty space that your father has left behind?
Well, my mother is a great mother, and I think I can't say that she could fill the empty space of a father, because, you know, fathers have their own roles in a child's life. But I think as a mother who didn't have her husband beside her, she's done real great, and what she did is really great, and I think not anyone can do what she did with me, with our life. She's a true hero, I guess. She had been able to handle all these years, 12 years alone, that's really impossible. I think I wouldn't be able to do that if I was in her situation. She's really strong, and I've never seen anyone like her.
So is she a role model to you?
Yes. I mean, in a lot of ways, she's a perfect woman in her life. And I think every woman needs to learn from her, and she is taught to listen to every woman, that especially the people who have the same conditions as us. She's a great role model. You know, what she does affects people, I think, in a good way, and we all need to learn from her.
And you're absolutely right when you describe her as a strong woman. I totally agree. Where do you think she gets her strength?
I don't know exactly, but at first her belief in God, because if someone believes in God, they become really stronger. And then her belief in the fact that my father is here and he can hear us. I think these two had made her so strong. And her personality is obviously really important. She had been a strong woman ever since she was born and a bit stubborn, but I guess that's what makes her so strong.
Well, recently you gave a lesson in nuclear diplomacy to the UN nuclear agency chief during his visit to Tehran with a powerful speech that grabbed headlines.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. I am Armitara Zayneja, daughter of one of the Iranian nuclear monsters. I welcome your presence in Iran. We are in the eve of a new year. I had a normal life 11 years ago, but 6 bullets ended that life. I was 4 and a half when my father was assassinated in front of my eyes. He was a scientist who had nothing to do with violence, and I am not the only one. But that's only a part of the story. Today, many patients lose their lives for the reason of receiving no medicine. Many people are crushed by the bad economic situation caused by the sanctions. The nation of Iran expects you to help us to improve our current state by giving impartial and fair reports about Iran's peaceful nuclear activities. Thank you.
How did you do that?
At first, my mother again. but then, at first I didn't want to do that. And I thought, okay, it's really scary to stand up there and hold people staring at you, and you have to speak in English. I'm not a native speaker of English. But then I realized that if I want the world to hear me, I should do that. It's really important. And my mother pushed me, and she said that you should do that. And that's the way it happened. I wasn't really prepared. I just started writing something really quick. And I hadn't even checked it with my mom. And she was like, okay, show it to me. And I said, no, I want to be what I be. I want it to be what I want it to be. And I went up there and said everything that I should have said.
So you just poured your heart out.
I guess we can say it was like that. Yeah.
There's also a viral video clip of you meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And you seem emotional in that video. Tell us more about that.
I had been waiting for that for a really long time. I mean, after the pandemic, we hadn't met him. I hadn't met him, and I was really waiting for this day to come. And I even cried over it once before that because I couldn't see him. I had cried a lot. And then when it happened, it was a shock. It was a shock and a surprise to me. We didn't expect that. And I was really emotional. And I couldn't control my myself, my hands and my voice. Yeah, I think it's pretty clear. And that's it. I
What does that visit mean to you?
A lot. It's nothing you can explain, like, in words. It can only be heard by the sound of heart, which I'm not really ready to do this. But, yes, I had really strong emotions at that time.
You sure did, and it was pretty obvious. So your father was martyred for a cause, and that's what martyrdom is all about. That is sacrificing your life for the greater good, if you will. And that's what your father did. And Iranians owe a lot to him. All of us, we owe a lot to him. As a young Iranian citizen and the daughter of this person, what kind of responsibility do you think you have?
Well, I think that every one of us, as an Iranian, we should try our best to continue what he had done. We should try to improve our country in a good way. We should try to go in a way that develop our country into make it better and better each day. With what we do, whatever we do, it's not important. We shouldn't just be in nuclear industry or something. Whatever you do, you should do it the best way that you can, so it'll help your people, the people of your country. I think that's the responsibility that everyone has.
And, of course, your father was active in the most important, probably, we can say, the most important scientific field, which is nuclear technology for peaceful purposes, of course, and that is what Iran has been doing over the past years. And Iran has made great achievements despite having to pay the price for it with martyrs like your dad. We have been able to make great achievements in the field of nuclear medicine and other peaceful applications of nuclear energy, such as agriculture. Do you know anything about this, and how proud of you of these achievements? And you were among the people who had to pay a hefty price for these achievements as well.
Yes, of course, I do know. I can't say I do know a lot, but I think it's really, really great that we're having this progress, and I think we can achieve even more in the future. Something that helps people, something that saves their lives, is really, really great and good. And I think the price I paid, my family paid, worth it for this progress to be made.
So you did describe your mom as a very strong woman and someone that has played a pivotal role in your life. Is there anything you want to tell her?
Well, I love you at first, and thank you for supporting me in all phases of my life. If she wasn't beside me, I wouldn't be able to do a lot of things that I had done, and I wouldn't, I'm a bit, kind of lazy, and she always pushes me and supports me and everything. I can't imagine a life without her. That would be terrific. The think of losing her terrifies me deep down.
So what do you have to say for teenagers, people your age in Iran? How can they make the best of the opportunities that life brings them?
The thing that I would like to say, I really love astronomy. As we know right now, the world is really, really big. And so big that we can't see a part of it. It's so far away that the light didn't have enough time to get to us.